You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Weber, and I'm the Assistant Dean for Career Services, and we are delighted to welcome you to today's program, Interweaving Strategy, Leadership, Web Entrepreneurship, and Social Sector Impact, and to introduce today's speaker, John Williams. Before starting, this program is co-sponsored by the Berkman Center, the Office of Public Interest Advising, the Dean's Office, as well as the Office of Career Services. I'm delighted to introduce today's speaker, John Williams. I met with John a few weeks ago, and as the head of Career Services, I am always interested in focusing on individuals' career paths. And after spending time with John, I can tell you that he has an incredibly interesting and inspiring career path, but also an extraordinary life story, which I think could be a screenplay someday. Although John will talk about both during his talk, I wanted to provide you with a few brief highlights about John's background. John is a partner in the Boston office of the Bridgespan Group, a nonprofit firm that works with mission-driven organizations and philanthropists to scale their impact, enhance their effectiveness, and help strengthen their leadership. Previously, John was a strategy consultant at Bain & Company, a software marketer, a senior executive at American Express, and an early dot-com entrepreneur and CEO of both Web 2.0 and private jet ventures. You can see he's done a lot of interesting things throughout his career. He graduated from Amherst College in 1975, and since 1984 has served on the Amherst College Board of Trustees, where he is a life trustee. John graduated with a JD and MBA from both the Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School in 1979, and John is also a private pilot, a musician, and a drummer. I'm also pleased to announce that John has agreed and will be Dean Minow's inaugural expert-in-residence appointment at the Harvard Innovation Lab, known as the iLab, where John will consult with and mentor students who are interested in entrepreneurship. And more information about this appointment will be forthcoming in the coming weeks. But for now, please join me in welcoming John Williams to campus.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, everybody. Can you guys hear me okay? I'm thrilled to be here with you. It's been a while since I was in your shoes, sitting in less auspicious, less well-appointed classrooms back in the late 70s. And I, when I was thinking about this talk, I was thinking, well, maybe three people will show up. But then I realized that they were offering food. And now I understand. So I'm going to spend about 40 minutes walking you through some aspects of my life and my career as it has unfolded. Hopefully, you're going to find some strands in there that will be of interest to you, and we'll leave lots of time, hopefully, at the end for questions. Which way? Okay. So I was going to start off with some lessons learned. First, be prepared, which all of you already know. I learned this early on in my career, three words as a mantra: listen, execute, and add. A lot of people get in trouble by not knowing to do all three of those things and not knowing in which order to do those things. A lot of people get the order confused. There are a lot of dead chickens in the middle of the road. We'll come back to that later. You can fail by being too successful, something I learned as an executive at American Express. Fail is probably a strong word there, but I'll talk a little bit about that. All change is disruptive. Whether or not it's change that you're inviting, change is disruptive. Know your customer. We all have customers no matter what we're doing. We're always selling. You're either gaining share or losing share was one of the first mantras I learned at Bain & Company. Know your customer. Pick your spots. This is something I've learned through my board service at Amherst that Mark referenced. I've been on that board for 28 years, so I've had a number of spots. But my first one was very moving for me. It pays who or whom you know. Think outside the box is something that has really been a thread throughout my career. There are good profits and bad profits. This is something I've learned only recently. And you may think I'm talking about despoiling the earth or something along those lines. I'm really talking about your relationship with your customers. There are profits that get generated by in a positive way with your relationship with your customers and the opposite. And we'll talk briefly about that. Shifting to the not-for-profit world, not-for-profits keep score differently. It's one of the main challenges of the social sector as compared to the private sector. The private sector has legions and legions of chief financial officers and financial people, managerial accounting, the Harvard Business School and others like it who are in business to teach you how to keep score. Social sector really doesn't have anywhere near as evolved a set of metrics for keeping score. We'll talk a little bit about that. Get clear, get real, and get better is a mantra for the social sector. Get clear about what you want to do, what you want to achieve, get real about what it's going to take, and then continuously find a way to get better at it. So those are the 12 lessons that I've learned so far. A little bit about my background. Who is it that's speaking with you today? I was born in New York City in 1954 to a German-American woman, an African-American father, and was put up for adoption in 1954 and was adopted a month after that as a month-old child and raised in a place called Westbury, New York. Anybody here from New York or Long Island? Okay. Westbury is in Nassau County. It's the little red marker down at the bottom of the slide. And so this map really defines my entire academic life. I grew up in Westbury. I think, is this a pointer yet? And went to prep school here, went to college here, and you know what happened around here. So that's my life. I went to Kent School in Connecticut. I had a wonderful mentor there, a man named William H. Armstrong, the author of a book, Sounder, that you may have heard of or read. He talked like this, and he used to just intimidate all the 13-year-old ninth-grade boys who were away from home for the first time. And he would say to me, "Mr. Williams, check your posture. You look like a spineless amoeba." And that was my orientation to really come up into the world. He wrote a book called Study is Hard Work, which all of you know how to do. His class was a wonderful transformational experience for me. He had a phrase in his office right next to the door that said, "Before the gates of excellence, the high gods have placed sweat," as a quote from Hesiod. I also learned how to program in BASIC, the BASIC language, back when I was 14 years old through a teletype, a terminal connected to Dartmouth. We were really fancy in those days. But that actually led me to be not computer phobic relative to a lot of people in my generation. So it was you never really know what's going to have an impact in your life later on. But the fact that I was exposed to BASIC as a high school student really helped me later in life. Be much more comfortable with technology than a lot of my contemporaries. I then went on to a real college, Amherst College in Western Mass, where I was an economics major. I wrote my senior thesis on improving low and income housing with a focus on New York City, worked with the Beverett-Stuyvesant Corporation in Brooklyn, and had no idea that was going to be a foreshadowing of an interest in social sector involvement later in life. I then came here to Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School, where I had some more Mr. Armstrong-like experiences in Phil Arita's, Professor Arita's class. I don't think any of you ever had a chance to meet him, but he was such an impressive professor. I had him for contracts, got an A in evidence under Charlie Nesson, I'm proud to say. and Professor Hexter over at the business school were some of my mentors. I actually wrote, just to tell you, give you a sense of what a nerd I am, I actually, in the first month of law school, first year law school, I wrote a little essay because I'd been an economics major in college. I wrote an essay as I was doing my notes, doing my contracts studying, a little essay on what's the rationale, what's the policy rationale for consideration as an economist might view it. So if you want to know more about that, I'll talk about that. Had a course at the business school first year that used to be called EAM, Environmental Analysis for Management. It's now called BIGE, I think, or it was recently. And the final exam was Iran. And this was in the spring of 1977. 2 years before the revolution in Iran. And I actually predicted in my blue book, based on the techniques that they had taught us at the business school, that there's very likely to be a revolution in Iran. So I felt pretty impressed 2 years later when there actually was. When I graduated, I took the New York and Massachusetts bar exam, so I'm a member of the bar in those two states. But I chose a business career, which was very, very late in my thinking. I was planning to be a corporate lawyer. I had done a summer at Cadwallader and had an offer there, but chose to do strategy consulting instead. I'll mention a little bit more about that, and have since become, as Mark mentioned, a corporate executive, an entrepreneur. A lot of people tell me I'm an out-of-the-box thinker and distinctively technology aware. So that's a little bit of background on me. Some of my early decisions. How many of you were here, you know, September, October of 1L year and finding out from people like Mark that you have to go, you know, interview for a summer job? That took me totally by surprise. I was certainly not ready for that. I had Professor Cox, Archibald Cox, for constitutional law. It was the third time I was taking con law, but it was totally an eye-opening experience for me. One of the things that was so jarring for me to discover was how politically oriented and outcome determinative those decisions are in many instances. That was really shocking for me. My first summer assignment at Cadwallader was to do a memorandum of law on Section 16B of the Exchange Act. If anybody know what that is, it's about short swing profits for insiders. It's against the law. It violates this statute to purchase and sell within 6 months by a director or a CEO or a corporate insider, the common stock of the company without disclosure. And I was asked to write a memorandum of law whether the purchase and subsequent sale of common versus convertible debentures, bonds that are convertible into common stock, was a violation of Section 16B. It's actually been amended, I think, since to address this issue. But at the time, there was no coverage in the statute, nor was there any case law on this question. So I did all my memorandum of law stuff that I'd learned here. And then since there was nothing on point, I went to, okay, what's the policy? And I concluded the policy was, well, it should really be a violation of the statute. And the partner called me and said, no, you don't understand. Our client has done this. I want to understand why it's not. It was another kind of moment for me in my legal career. I had concluded for me, investment banking, what do they add? What value do they add? Silly me. So these are some early career decisions I'm sharing with you that hopefully will inform some of your thinking. I had a professor at the business school who pulled me aside midway through my first year and said, "Have you ever considered a career in marketing? You're pretty good at this stuff." And that was another one of those moments of intervention by a mentor that really helped me in my career. My third summer, because I did the JD MBA program, I had three summers, and I did the first two at law firms, one Cadwallader, Wickersham and Taft on Wall Street, another midtown firm in New York City. And then the third summer, I decided, well, I might at some point think about doing business, so let me work for BCG or Bain. And so I worked for Bain & Company, and it was a fabulous experience. My first business trip was a flight at like 6:45 or 6:40 out of Logan to go to St. Louis. to a meeting with Monsanto, and I overslept. And I was living in Harvard Square, and I drove a Volkswagen Beetle, and I just jumped out of bed and ran into my car and drove 80 miles an hour at Storrow Drive at 6 a.m. Nobody was on Storrow Drive, and just made the flight. The manager, which is a big deal role at Bain, who was traveling with me, had work to do, so he wanted to keep me quiet. So he did kind of a post-interview question for me to get me quiet. So you might want to write this down. I'm going to say it twice. A is 24 and is twice as old as B was when A was as old as B is now. A is 24 and is twice as old as B was when A was as old as B is now. How old is B? Extra credit for anybody in the Q&A session who gets the answer right. The answer is not 12. So then at the end of that summer, I got a permanent offer with Bain and really struggled because from the time I'd been admitted to Amherst, I was planning on a corporate law career. And I really struggled with the decision between Bain and Cadwalader. And I ultimately decided to go to Bain & Company. I got what many of you may have heard about, although I think it's been outlawed for so long you may not have heard about it. There used to be these things called exploding offers. You ever heard about this? Well, Bain gave me an offer for a base salary and a sign-on bonus, where the sign-on bonus declined after 3 days of not declining. After every subsequent day, it would decline by 10%. So you could decide at any given day to accept or reject the offer, but they were giving you a financial incentive to respond early. I got that from Mitt Romney, who used to be a partner at Bain & Company, and we all know who he is now. So that's a little bit of my background. By the way, I subsequently did find out what investment bankers do. They make a lot of money. This is some of the fees they made on the recent Groupon IPO. So I went to work for Bain & Company, which does strategy consulting. This is where I learned listen, execute, and add in that order. I also learned that strategy is often the exercise in deciding to go left or go right, but not to be kind of one part or the other. That's where the phrase, a lot of dead chickens in the middle of the road, comes from. I did some work for Firestone, which was subsequently acquired by a Japanese company called Bridgestone, but there are still some Firestone auto service firms out there. I convinced them to fundamentally change their inventory program and invest $1.5 billion in stocking auto parts to provide better service for their customers and make more money. Worked for Burlington Industries and forecasted denim demand, mostly driven by cohort analysis of jean consumption, blue jeans consumption, based on what stage of life, whether you're a teenager, a preteen, or a young adult, et cetera. It turns out that there are patterns to this consumption, and the demographic changes could really help you understand what the forecast would be. Did some work for a company called Gould, which you probably never heard of, but they manufactured copper foil, which is used in printed circuit boards, and the thinner the better. And that actually took me to Japan to do some research. I was one of the founding members of the Bain Band, and that's where my singing and drumming comes in. And I sang a version of the Beatles song Let It Be at a company meeting. And that actually transformed how I was perceived at Bain & Company. I was previously perceived as this really fabulous, excellent, really smart analyst and consultant. And after that, I was just perceived as this, great singer and drummer. So that was a lesson. Be careful what you ask for. I left Bain as a case team leader 5 years after joining there, in part because I felt I was living my life at an average altitude of 15,000 feet, and I needed to have a more stable personal life. But this was around the time when the Apple II was out and about, and VisiCalc. We didn't even have Lotus 1-2-3, which you guys have never heard of, at that point, way before Excel came around, but did have some opportunity to start using PCs, which led to an entrepreneurial experience right after that. One of the things I learned at Bain is what is strategy in a for-profit and the for-profit world? Two main questions. What businesses should we be in? You may have seen this whole framework by a professor at the business school named Porter, who has talked about the four forces. And there's a lot of frameworks for strategy, but this is probably one of the most famous. So which businesses should we participate in? And there are a lot of factors that go into deciding which business sectors, which businesses are more attractive than others. And then subsequently, how can we outperform competitors in that business or those businesses? So which businesses to be in and how to outperform competitors. A big portion of outperforming competitors historically has been how do you get more market share than your competitors? How do I outperform my competitors and get more market share? Because the entity that has the greatest market share has the greatest amount of experience. And experience leads to lower costs. Lower costs than your competitors leads to greater margins than your competitors, all things being equal. And so you're going to have a relative market power and profitability. So these are some of the elements of strategy within a for-profit world. How do you keep score? You keep score in the for-profit world through very, very well understood, generally accepted accounting principles that lead to records of sales, net income, assets, and market capitalization. How much is our company worth? That's how you keep score in the for-profit world. This doesn't tell you much about how to do things in the not-for-profit world. We'll come to that later on. I subsequently, after a couple of other things, went to American Express, where I was Senior Vice President of Strategic Planning. This is a time when I actually, using my legal background, recommended to American Express that they sue Visa and MasterCard under antitrust grounds for restraint of trade. They didn't listen to me at the time, but I tend to be kind of 5 or 10 years ahead of myself. And in fact, they did wind up going against Visa and MasterCard and on antitrust grounds and prevailed. I then was the general manager of the Platinum Card. At the time, it was the top card in the hierarchy of American Express cards. There's subsequently been introduced something called the Centurion Card, which is a black card. Many you may have one, or your parents or family members may have one. But I totally repositioned the Platinum Card at a time in the early 90s during a recession when it was very difficult it had become difficult for the Platinum Card to succeed in a fundamentally altered environment. Became the head of marketing information services at American Express in the mid-90s at a time when the Internet hadn't really even been created yet other than DARPANET. And the way you got online was to work with one of the online services, such as AOL or, I can't even remember the others, CompuServe and Prodigy, right? And so I actually made the judgment that if I was going to take American Express card members online, that I wanted to do so in an environment, in a user interface, where they were going to have a wonderful experience. Even though CompuServe and Prodigy had 1 million members at the time, which was thought to be huge at that time, and AOL only had 600,000 subscribers, some paltry number, made the decision for American Express to work with AOL, and I should have bought more stock. And then I also, at the end of my career at American Express, I was there from 88 to 96, ran the consumer travel division, which is all the American Express travel offices from Maine to Hawaii, about 214 owned offices and another 400 or so representative offices, and transformed that division in a number of ways. This is an example of thinking outside the box. Have you seen this exercise, 9 dots? If you haven't, draw these 9 dots on your page and try to connect them all with 4 straight lines without taking your pen off the paper. See if you can do that. Has anybody not seen this exercise? Who has not seen this exercise? Okay. If you've seen it before, then you know the way to achieve this is to think outside the box. So an example of that from my career is the consumer travel network at American Express. When I took over this division, it was probably one of the oldest businesses at American Express, predated the card division, had been in business for some 40 or 50 years. Everyone who had run this business before me had viewed it geographically. So there, within an office, there was an office manager, and that those offices were grouped into districts, and those districts were grouped into regions. And so there was this geographical frame of reference in thinking about the organization of the business. One of the critical aspects of strategy that I learned early in my career at Bain and at the business school was to understand what business you're in, right? Going back to those two questions about how do you think about strategy in the for-profit world. What businesses are we in? So I spent 6 months traveling around the country to all these different offices from Maine to Hawaii, as I said, and talking to frontline employees and talking to customers. And I discovered that we were in three individual businesses: leisure travel, business travel, and financial services. I can go into the details afterwards if you're interested in. But they're fundamentally different businesses. The employees are different. The skills that they have are different. And so I suggested another perspective on this business, which was to think about the business from a business perspective rather than from a geographic perspective. And so the implication of that was, for example, in the Boston area, each one of those red markers is where a travel office is. So under the prior structure, each one of those offices would have had an office manager responsible for all three of those businesses. And this is how the paradigm worked: an office manager per office, eight offices, eight managers. Under my new paradigm, there was a business manager for each of those three businesses cutting across all eight of the offices. So we went from eight managers to three managers, but also more empowered frontline employees. And what happened was, across the entire network, a 34% reduction in field management expense with a lot of time. We spent 9 to 12 months finding alternative positions for those managers, other places within the company, or helping them find other places outside of American Express. But at the same time, a 6% increase in revenue because we had more focused management attention on each one of those businesses. Interestingly enough, those managers, various managers and district managers, et cetera, tended to have a preference for one or one of those three businesses instead of the other two. And so with more focused management attention, we're able to actually increase the top line. The combination of the reduction in expense and the growth in revenue resulted in a 4x profit increase over the next year. A major change required a lot of management effort. As I said, it took 9 months to implement. That's an example of all change is disruptive. We spent a lot of time working with the field management organization on that, managing it through, and I'm proud to say that this worked out extremely well and successfully for the people involved as well as for the company. I left American Express after 8 years there to become a web internet entrepreneur. Back in 1996, I was called by a recruiting firm to come be the CEO of a company that had one employee. So I left American Express to become CEO of what became biztravel.com. You won't find it now because it's gone through a lot of ups and downs and was acquired by another firm. But at the time, in the mid-90s, it was actually seen as one of the best travel sites and was selected for the Webby Award, the best travel site in the travel category. So a lot of exciting things I can talk to you about if you're interested, but was a fabulous experience for me to grow a company from one employee to about 80 employees when we eventually sold the business. We went from zero to 600,000 customers over the first couple of years. I had a number of venture capital investors as well as corporate investors. The lead investor was Comcast. I wound up raising about $20 million in venture funding from those VC firms as well as corporate funders in two rounds of financing. Essentially, what happened was the airlines killed the business, the online business, for all but the online websites that you typically use today. So you're probably using either Orbitz or Travelocity or Expedia or the airline sites themselves. They really killed this business by reducing the commission to online travel sites, which pushed out the break-even volume for this business from what was maybe $10 or $20 million of travel services booked to $1 billion. And my investors didn't have the deep pockets for this. So we sold the company. Everyone made money. But it was a success, but it wasn't a grand slam by any means. Another entrepreneurial experience I had was in the private jet world. Mark mentioned that I'm a pilot. I've been flying since, 1983. And so I combined my experience in affluent customers from American Express with my piloting expertise and was the CEO of a company that used to be called eBizJets, which is now Sentient Jet. It's a private jet charter brokerage. I led the company from $8 million in revenue to $54 million in 2 years, built out the organization, did a number of things. The company is very interesting. In the private jet world, you think it's pretty simple. Customer wants to go from A to B. But what happens if the customer wants to stay there for a while? They chartered this jet. What happens to the jet? Does it stay there? No, it goes back. So it goes back. It tends to go back empty. It's called an empty leg. Very, very unprofitable, very expensive. So what Sentient did was said, you know what? We'll work with a number of different charter companies, and we'll put customers together. So we eventually got the jet back to its point of origin, but by combining a number of other customer flights, so eliminating the empty legs as much as possible and tremendously more profitable for the operators of the jet, less costly for the customers to not have to pay for empty legs, and very successful. That's in part what drove the revenue growth from 8 to 54 million in a couple of years. Venture capital behind both of those entrepreneurial experiences. A number of you are potentially interested in venture opportunities. One of the things that's happening very recently is a change in the dynamics of funding for ventures. Venture capital firms have been moving upstream to what's called mezzanine or second round or third round financing, and there are incubating firms like Y Combinator who have emerged and angel investors. Also, the entry point, the amount of capital required to start a business these days is less than it used to be. And so a lot of those factors have combined to result in venture capital firms not being as much of a play in early stage companies as they used to be, and incubators and angels being much more of a source of funding and for new companies. So entrepreneurship, this is a quote from the man who brought you Samuel Adams a beer, who says, the chances of a small business making you really wealthy are quite small, but the chances of a small business giving me a life that I truly enjoy, becoming happy, I got a really good shot at that. That's how I ended up in brewing. So one of the things to balance in thinking about ventures is what are your motives? Are your motives financial? Are your motives interesting life, doing your passion? I think my advice is to try to combine the two. Try to combine your passion with an interest in financial success if that's your goal, or social sector success if that's your goal. Another perspective is customer loyalty. I mentioned earlier, know your customer and treat them well, and also the proverb that there are good profits and bad profits. I was the executive director of something called the NPS Loyalty Forum. NPS, has anybody heard of NPS? NPS is Net Promoter Score. It's a metric for thinking about customer loyalty. And you may have seen surveys where you're asked, how likely are you to recommend a business to friends or colleagues? That's Net Promoter Score. If you answer 9 or 10, you're classified as a promoter. If you answer 7 or 8, you're classified as a passively satisfied customer. If you answer 0 to 6, you're classified as a detractor. One's net promoter score is the number of promoters minus the number of detractors divided by the total number of respondents. And it turns out that this leads to the notion of good profits and bad profits. If you're a company that generates a lot of promoters, you're a company like some of these companies. Apple, Google, some of the most admired companies. They're most admired because they do a really great job with their customers. They have customer-rewarding business models. Those models make profits, but in a way that the customer doesn't resent. The customer wants to do business with these companies, wants to buy more of their products, more of their services, even though, you know, the company, they're happy that the company is making money. So these are, that's an example of, these are examples of good profits. In contrast, there's a list that the Nonprofit Quarterly just published of the most hated companies. I had never heard of some of these companies. Anybody from the D.C. area know Pepco? Hate it? I don't know. But this is the list. This is not my list. This is the Nonprofit Quarterly. I'm a little surprised that Facebook is in the middle of this list. But if you look at this list, it's mostly monopolies, airlines, wireless providers, and banks. And if you think about those business models, a lot of those business models, like wireless, where you're locked into a two-year contract and you can't wait to get out, or banks with a lot of annoying fees, a lot of these industries are reputed within business and consumer research to have what are known as customer-hostile business models, models that are requiring the customer to pay fees, et cetera, that or business terms and conditions that the customer is not thrilled by. These companies make money too, but in the context of net promoter score, these can be thought of as examples of bad profits. Problem with good profits and bad profits is the accountants can't tell the difference. So the whole generally accepted accounting principles makes no provision for good profits or bad profits. And so general managers of companies or startups or big companies have to really be thinking about this independently from the financial statements to really think about, are they building a company that's going to grow and be thriving with a customer franchise, or one that's eating essentially its young in terms of its customer relationships? I'm going to turn to philanthropy now, and we're all mourning the passing of Steve Jobs. But Steve really thought differently, and I introduced the topic of philanthropy, perhaps ironically, with Steve, because he was known, he's notable for having rejected philanthropy and thought that it was not something that was a high priority for him. His comment, in fact, was, in order to learn how to do something well, you have to fail sometimes. And the problem with most philanthropy is that there's no measurement system. You can never really measure whether you failed or succeeded, so it's hard to get better. That was his perspective on philanthropy. And, you know, there's a lot of need out there in the world. You know, the question is, are we up to the challenge? Certainly, we remember Katrina, the environmental disaster in the Gulf, where we are in terms of the listing of academic performance, in this case mathematics, compared to Singapore and South Korea and some of the others. We're break-even now with 2007. We've, through a lot of slow growth and work, have gotten our gross domestic product back up to even where we were in 2007. It's a challenging time we're all living with. If you look at recessions, this is the most jobless recession. There's been a lot of coverage on that. But these lines are how the jobs come back after an initial recession. This is the longest standing recession we've had in a long time. Is the American dream over? Is a question that a lot of people are asking. The haves and have-nots, income inequality is a real issue for our nation. It's been growing. The yellow bars are the ratio of the 95th percentile to the 20th percentile of income distribution, and that ratio has been increasing dramatically since the 1970s. The mobility that one has from being in the bottom fifth or the bottom quartile, the bottom quintile, to the top, or any mobility that you'd care to articulate, has become much more challenging over the years. This is a comparison relatively of income inequality across multiple countries, where you've got a lot of the Scandinavian countries and Japan on the far left, and USA, UK, Portugal, Singapore on the far right. And interestingly enough, I don't know if you watch TED Talks. This is an interesting TED Talk by a gentleman named, I think it's Richard Wilkinson, who has done an analysis, and this is one of the slides that he shows, of a very tight relationship between income inequality on the x-axis and index of health and social problems within that country on the y-axis, showing that there seems to be a very strong relationship between the income inequality, those countries where income is more unequal, and those countries where there are more health and social problems. And the vertical axis is just an index of a lot of different aspects of social malaise. Certainly, this is a time of great social and political unrest, where it's also a time of great public health concern in a number of areas for us. Global warming. I mean, the list just goes. I mean, is it depressing to be, in your generation? My goodness. One of the things that we don't hear a lot about is the huge migration, the largest migration in human history is happening in China right now from the rural west to the urban east. More millions of people are migrating from the farms in the rural western part of China to the cities in the urban east. This is a major concern for the leadership of China, is how to manage the expectations of this population. AIDS in Africa primarily and elsewhere. The global population explosion, we're kind of right here. We're at 7 billion, I think, last week, and we're about to be at 10 in a few years. And that has tremendous issues for us from a social standpoint. So how do you deal with this? At Bridgespan, where, as Mark mentioned, I'm a partner, we think about strategic clarity for not-for-profits in a different framework than that which I learned at Bain for the for-profit world. We take the mission and the programs and services of a not-for-profit that we work with, and we ask two fundamental questions. One is the who and the what questions. What's your intended impact? What are you trying to achieve in terms of not dollars and cents because you're a not-for-profit organization? What's your intended impact on the world? How will the world be different as a result of what you're doing? Who are you trying to serve? What are you trying to accomplish with that audience, with that population? And what's your theory of change? How is what you're doing going to achieve that impact? So who are you going out to address? What are you trying to accomplish with them in terms of impact? Not outcomes, not the fact that they graduated from high school or they graduated from college, but what impact is that going to have on their lives? So outcomes are really different from impact. And then how are you going to achieve that? So working with clients, one of our longest standing clients is the Harlem Children's Zone in New York City, led by a very well-regarded gentleman named Jeffrey Canada, where the mission is to improve the lives of poor children in America's most devastated communities. The intended impact is pretty complicated. I'm not going to read this whole slide, but it really focuses in on a zone defined by a neighborhood of a community within Harlem and on children. So the who is the children within this zone of a community within Harlem. The theory of change is to do a number of initiatives to address the lives of those children within that community. In focusing in on the intended impact and the theory of change, Harlem Children's Zone had to make a lot of key decisions that were surprising for them. They wound up transferring a senior center that they had. They had grown over the years in lots of ways. Lots of not-for-profits grow a little bit like Topsy, doing a lot of different things that may or may not be directly related to their strategy. So they had done that as well. So they transferred a senior center to another agency. They transferred the dropout prevention program located outside the zone to another agency. They did a number of things to align what they were doing with their intended impact and theory of change, to the great surprise of Jeffrey Canada and their board. Their biggest surprise was to discover just how much money was going into programs that didn't meet our core mission. So that's just a glimpse into strategy within the not-for-profit world, where the mantra is get clear on what you're doing, get real about what it's going to require, and get better at what you're doing. Another approach to that is to work within for-profit companies on programs and strategies that combine what they're interested in doing from a profitability standpoint with doing good work in the world and the community. Examples of that are the Prius, Nestle in the developing world, and interestingly enough, Google is trying to generate as much electricity as possible in green ways. I'm just going to end my presentation with some teaching and reflection from the Dalai Lama, who, when asked what surprised him most about humanity, said man, because he sacrifices his health in order to make money, then he sacrifices money to recuperate his health, then he's so anxious about the future he does not enjoy the present, the result being that he does not live in the present or the future. He lives as if he is never going to die and then dies never having really lived. Pretty profound. So that's a little bit about my life and what I've done. There's a lot of other things. I'm a pilot. I drive motorcycles. I'm interested in cosmology. But I'll stop there and open the floor for any questions you guys may have. Yes?
I'm curious to know how you think that your legal education helped you in your career as a consultant.
The question is, how did my legal education help me in my career as a consultant? But I presume you would extend that to other things that I've done. It's a great question, and I think if I had to do it over again, I would do both the law and business degrees as well. I've had a lot of opportunities to think about business problems, incorporating a legal perspective, and been informed by that. If you think about the combination of my economics undergrad, my MBA, and law school, it's tremendous background in the American or the world's capitalist system. And so there's been a number of examples of cases where I've really kept the attorneys honest. There have been a number of situations where the corporate attorneys wanted us to not even consider options, that because of my legal education, I knew we had alternatives that we could examine. And I pointed out those alternatives. Sometimes we wound up taking one of those alternatives. Sometimes we didn't. But I found that by having some background in the law, I was able to have a more kind of even-keeled conversation, particularly with the company's lawyers, about things. Other questions?
Wait, so were they trying to get you to do things that, or pursue options that were both beneficial for you, the company, and them because of the billing hours? So, like, why wouldn't they give you all the options?
You know, it's a good question. I actually don't know the answer. My speculation has always been that these options required them to work harder than they might have been interested in doing. Oftentimes, it wasn't a law firm, so it wasn't a billable hours question. It was, do we even want to go there? Is that too risky for us to consider? In my view, it's really management's job to assess those trade-offs between risk and reward, and it's the attorney's job to point out the options and to advise the executives, and that's one of the reasons why I chose the business career instead of the legal career. I think for each individual, one has to come to the determination of which of those roles makes most sense for you, judging your own personality, your own aspect for thinking about your role in life. Which of those roles do you most want to play? I discovered for myself when I was going through graduate school very late in the process that I was more risk tolerant, more interested in being one of the business people making the decision rather than the advisor. But a lot of people, a lot of my best friends are very comfortable, very excited being the advisor and not wanting to be the business person. So I think it may have been an orientation around risk tolerance is probably the best answer to your question. Yes, sir.
I hate if this is too specific of a question, but when you were at American Express and you looked around at the travel business and decided it wasn't geographic, but you actually had, I think, three different businesses,
yes.
Luxury, business, I think, and consumer, I think is what they were.
Leisure travel, business travel, and financial services.
How would you synthesize an overall strategy when you basically had three completely different businesses?
That's a great question. The question was how to synthesize an overall strategy when you have three businesses. The answer is you have to have a strategy for each one of those businesses. You have to have a business strategy, and then you can have a strategy for the organization that allocates resources around a portfolio of businesses. So there are many companies that have a multitude of businesses, and actually you may have seen a tool from the late 80s or the mid-80s and into the 90s called the Growth Share Matrix, which talks about a portfolio of companies, cash cows and stars and question marks and dogs. That's a relationship between relative market share and growth rate. There tends to be a cycle of growth from the nascent stages of a product life cycle to the highly intensive growth segment to the mature segment, and then relative market share. Those two things combine for given businesses to have different financial characteristics of growth and resource intensity. So that's an example of a tool that's used by many companies, or used to be at least, to think about a portfolio of businesses so that you might have one strategy for a company that's in an early nascent stage, high growth industry and has a position in that business that you can drive to dominance before the market growth rate slows. And that strategy could be very different from an organization that is part of the overall company but is in a much slower growth, more mature industry. A company like GE, for example, has this problem all the time, where each of its divisions is in a very different sector, plastics and jet engines, et cetera, and consumer products. So you have to develop a strategy for each one of those businesses and then allocate resources across them.
Do you have the same people selling for all three different businesses?
No, that's the question was, are the same people selling all three businesses? One of the ways that you can determine what is and is not an inchoate business is to think about what's the overlap between the skills of the individuals involved. And it turns out that selling leisure travel is fundamentally different from selling business travel. Leisure travel is a consultative process that involves a lot of engagement with the customer. Usually it's more than one person because people don't tend to go on vacations by themselves. So it's a loved one or a family. Whereas business travel, it's order taking. It's air, car, and hotel. The trip is determined independent of the individual. Leisure and financial services is entirely different, much like banking, right, with anti-money laundering considerations, et cetera, and risk inherent in taking the cash at the end of the day to a Dropbox or to a bank. So there are very fundamentally different aspects to each one of those three businesses, and each of the employees had different skills and training involved. And that was one of the things that helped me understand that we were really in three different businesses. Yes?
Why are bad profits bad? I guess I kind of see that, like, I mean, when people don't like it, that's generally bad. But for a business, are they bad because they lead to worse business in the future? Because at first I thought that might be the case, but I looked at the list, and they all seem like pretty successful companies. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering what your thoughts on that were.
Absolutely. Bad profits are profits that are earned at the expense of your relationship with your customer. Profits that are earned in a process that results in your customer being less likely to do business with you if they had a choice than they were before they engaged with you. Good profits are profits that are reinforcing of the relationship with the customer, where the customer, through their interaction with you, wants to do more business with you. And in the course of that interaction is generating profits for you, but that's a positive cycle. Companies that are earning bad profits are earning profits. As I said, the accountants can't tell the difference. But they have to reinvest in acquiring more and more customers who they've not dealt with before, or they have to have business models such as utilities or monopolistic situations or customer contracts that really lock the customer in and prevent the customer from exiting where the customer would prefer to because of the way in which they've been dealt by the company. So bad profits is a sense of, it's not bad in the pejorative sense of it's doing ill to society in some way. It's just that it's profits that are being earned in a way that are deleterious to the future growth and success of the company. because of its relationship with its customers. Does that clarify?
Yeah.
Does that help?
I guess I'm curious, and do you think that those businesses would do better if they were to move away from a bad profit model to a good profit model?
In industry after industry after industry, it's been shown, and if you want examples, I would encourage you to go to look at the MPS Loyalty Forum website, on which I think you can find, if you just Google MPS Loyalty Forum. You'll be able to find some examples of that, and if you want to follow up with me, come talk afterwards. I'll give you my card.
I think that makes me even more annoyed that they would be doing something that's against their business interests and against the consumer's interests.
Well, a lot of people are just not aware of this, and it's also a case of the difference between short-term thinking and longer-term thinking. So one of the things that you'll find is that a number of executives, unfortunately, and we see this in politics, unfortunately, where people have a time horizon that as long as it works on my time horizon of the next 2 years or 4 years, whatever that horizon is, then I'll make the decision that works within that time horizon, which may not be in the best interest of the organization, but works for them. Unfortunately, that's part of the reality that every organization has to deal with.
John, this should be in the last question.
Okay,
for
thanks, Mark.
Purposes of time.
Okay. Yes.
I have a question about, you know, one of the most noticeable things about the two different ways you analyze strategy in the private sector versus the not-for-profit sector was the private sector model was obviously very conscious of where that organization and that project fit in the kind of macro sense. You know, it was cognizant of what its suppliers were and particularly what its competition is. Mm-hmm. Whereas the not-for-profit strategy was very internally focused and only looking at, you know, well, what do we want to do and how can we do that best. And I understand why that makes sense at that micro level. But at the macro level, my understanding is, you know, in the not-for-profit world, there's a big concern about kind of misallocation of resources that, you know, there's some particular causes that are probably overfunded relative to others. You know, not that anything's overfunded in the absolute sense, but in a relative sense. And I guess, you know, thinking about what you're working on in the longer term, I mean, what does it do when you only take that internal-looking mission as far as the greater cause of getting, you know, all these different issues appropriately funded and appropriately addressed? To what extent, you know, would you advise your clients to be cognizant of, you know, those type of concerns?
Question was, how do you, is there a difference between for-profit and not-for-profit in terms of looking in a macro way in the for-profit world versus looking more internally in the not-for-profit world? I may have miscommunicated. Not-for-profit organizations don't focus only internally. They're very focused on the external world of their constituents, of their beneficiaries. So if you're trying to, you know, improve the life experience of underprivileged youth developing in a particular community or set of communities, you're very focused on those on that constituency and that external you know, beneficiaries of what you're about. So there's not an internal focus. There is equally an external focus on who you're trying to benefit with your efforts.
Well, my question was a little bit, to use an analogy, if you were advising a company that was in the blue jeans business, and you're looking at the scene, you're saying, well, look, there's 10 other companies that are selling blue jeans to teenagers, but nobody's selling them to the 50-plus crowd. So it makes sense to go there, even though you came to me and we started this meeting talking about selling blue jeans to teenagers.
Right.
And the difference would be the not-for-profit space when you're saying, well, look, I want to focus on at-risk youth in Harlem. Then you say, okay, great, let's do that. And let's focus on doing that well without, at least as I understood the diagram, taking a step back and be like, well, how many other people are doing this?
Right.
What other what other sectors aren't being serviced in that area? And I guess that's my concern.
I understand your question better now. That question really goes to intended impact. If because a particular group is already well served by a number of other programs from other organizations, if your work is not going to have much beneficial impact because they're already pretty well served, then that's where the question of your intended impact and the analysis of it comes into play in our work with our clients. So it's your intended impact and your theory of change. So what are you intending to have as your impact on that society, on that group? If they're already very well served, it's going to be hard for you to have a very significant impact. And what's your theory of change? How are you going to achieve that impact? if you're doing just what a bunch of other not-for-profits or for-profit philanthropic arms of for-profit companies are doing to help those people, then again, you're not going to be able to be very effective in achieving your intended impact. So that very much comes into play in strategic analysis working in the not-for-profit world, is really looking at what impact are you trying to achieve, and that very much involves who you're targeting for your intervention, whose lives are you trying to benefit, or what societal condition are you trying to affect, and how are you trying to affect that? If something that is already being accomplished by somebody else, yes, the answer might be to look elsewhere for better opportunities to make change. That said, in the philanthropic world, all philanthropy is personal. So you may just care about this neighborhood in Harlem a lot more than you care about other places. And so in contrast to the for-profit world, where the metric is maximizing shareholder value, where your shareholders really don't care where you have a preference, if you're not going to make more money for them by choosing to serve the market that you choose to serve, then you're really not doing your job for the shareholders. In the not-for-profit world, it's about matching your passion and your interests with the needs out there in the marketplace. And subject to analysis of intended impact and theory of change, absolutely, but marrying that with your interests and your passions to do, you know, to really transform lives and transform social conditions, all that comes into play in the not-for-profit world. Mark? Thank you very much.
Now you can see why he's going to be a phenomenal mentor and advisor to any of you who are considering entrepreneurship. So stay tuned for further details about John's forthcoming appointment. And thank you for a phenomenal.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Mark. Thanks, everyone, for coming.